It sounds like that's what you just said, Ben, that it's sort of a feeling that you are the universe. And it being, I guess, as Heidegger would say, and the existential philosopher Heidegger would say, being at home in the world in the sense that you finally felt part of it in a and were at peace with it. Is that, am I completely off base? Am I extrapolating too much, or is that what those experiences have been like for you guys? As I know you've done the work and been through the struggles, so I'm just wondering how you got where you are and how it feels as opposed to where you were before.
Being that I'm heavily involved in the 12-step program, the main crux, it's based in spirituality, it's based in having a higher power, but it's a God of your understanding, and I think that's critical. And I think that does relate to what Henry's talking about, taking pieces from these different traditions. Now, for myself, when I feel at one with God and my surroundings and with other people, in my head, it's a Christian perspective. And it's not that I believe my Christian perspective is superior, but because of the way I was raised, because of the karma that brought me up to this point, today at least, I'm a Christian.
So the Christian symbolism is that just what it is for you? It's more your way of modeling or symbolizing the spiritual process of redemption and the order of the universe as you understand it.
Yeah, and I can't explain it. When I look around, I feel like God has placed literally every person walking by me, the garbage can, the snow, the blade of grass, the garbage on the ground that's blowing. I feel like he's placed everything, including myself, exactly where it has to be in my nature, in my personal nature, not the external nature. Christianity just resonates with me.
It sounds like what you were describing.
I think too, there's a line, and I just picked up the AA book. William James talks about spiritual experiences of the educational variety, and that they're not all aha moments of white light and the clouds part and all that. You know what I mean? That sometimes I think with my journey with dysmorphia and psychosis, when I look back, I wrote an article on my experience with the body. You know what I mean? And when I look back, it all made sense. You know what I mean? It's kind of in hindsight that like I had to go through that to get to this feeling of to really feel that, like, yeah, that extra sensitivity is a gift now that I can really breathe deeply and really feel safe in my body as a form of refuge and get deeper with my meditation. But I think there's also those moments where, you know, you're standing on a mountain range and you realize just how cool this world is. And I've had moments of real suffering that have broken through. I had a breakup, you know what I mean? And I realized that, like, hey, this girl and me are not two. You know what I mean? She's a symbol that I'm hung up on it because it's me. It's a reflection of me. You know what I mean? And I've had real aha moments like that, so I think it can be both. I think it can be slower burn, educate. They call it the education, spiritual awakening of the educational variety, where you kind of look back in hindsight and, hey, this was all pretty connected, and this all kind of made sense in the end. Or you can get those little hot shots of glimpses of like enlightenment moments where it's like, wow, we're not two. You know, this is cool. So that's my take.
Is the sense of connection, is that what you lose when you're suffering, that you gain when you I don't know, when you feel better about everything and you feel
That's, I
more?
mean, that's the school of that Zen would believe that, the sense of separate
Yeah,
self,
sure.
right? You know what I mean? And I'm a Zen Buddhist, you know what I mean? The sense of separation. And I would feel that in my body. Like, think about when you're suffering, what your body feels like. It's tense. The blood pressure is up, the lactic acid in your muscles. You can feel when you're dialed in, you can feel really loose and kind of one with the air around you. But when you're suffering, this coarse kind of, you know what I mean? It's you against the world. And I think that sense of separateness is a theme you could definitely pull.
And I just asked that because I at some, my well, I guess I may have said this on other discussions, but I guess the spiritual tradition philosophy that I feel maybe most at home with is something like the Advaita Vedanta tradition and Hinduism, that's main underlying theme, right, is that we are nature, we are all one ultimately, and we are nature having taken on different forms, but what causes suffering is when we become so attached to these individual forms and all the individual forms that comprise existence, and we forget our homeness and that our oneness with, if you want to call it, nature or the universe. And it just sounds like what you guys are saying would fit very well in that tradition, meaning that your sense of finding better grounding and peace has come through realizing this deep connection and being at home in the universe, if you want to call it that. Is that fair?
Yeah, I've never heard of that tradition, and so much of what I believe already, you know what I mean? So that's again back to Henry's point about finding the weaving thread and that lines these up. So that's cool.
Yeah, I was sorry, there was so much. Oh, geez. The comment on symbols, just to kind of go back a little bit, getting into, Henry's comments on nature. The thing, and maybe this has already been talked about, and maybe you all have the same view, but in your own way, the thing for me is being humble. And I like the hierarchy that there is, you could call it ultimate reality in certain circles. For me, it's God. So God is in charge. And then I have to humble myself and be subordinate to him. And also, when I deal with people, it translates to when I deal with people, I have to see the divinity in them and humble myself to them too, which for me is a struggle sometimes. I have a master's degree. I worked at NASA. I was on a record label. Why are you like, I have some old habits. The point is though, I have that in my head, but I'm trying to learn, and the Christian faith that I've attached to is teaching me that. Humble yourself, and so I'm working on that. But I do realize I can learn something from a 2-year-old child to a 99-year-old person. Every person I meet teaches me something. All one, two, are there four other people in this room? All of you have taught me something.
Those sort of very Taoist kind of reversal, paradoxical. He who humbles himself will be exalted. He who exalts himself will be humbled. He who seeks to gain his life must lose it. He who loses his life will find it. The last shall be first, and the first shall be last. I mean, I can think, right? There's so many of those, and they all seem to point very much to what I hear you saying, I think, Andy.
So I was talking to a Christian friend of mine who's been on other podcasts, and we were talking about the Jesus prayer. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And so I told him, beautiful prayer, but I never say the last phrase. It's enough to say, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me. And there's this interesting paradox. I don't have any trouble knowing that there are powers greater than my individual self. I see that every day. That doesn't mean I don't have agency. If God made me, how can I be unworthy? So it's like, in the natural course of things, a mosquito can kill me. I can get encephalitis if a particular mosquito carrying something bites me. In that instance, it's much more powerful than I am. So it's kind of relative. Overdoing the sinner thing, overdoing the powerless thing is giving away the power that the universe has given everybody, every part of creation. You just can't take it to an extreme. You're not the, as one of our Sufi teachers, I only know this by history because I never met him, but he would say, you act like you're the whale excrement at the bottom of the ocean. You're not. So, but that doesn't mean that you're the equivalent of God. It means you're worthy. You have a role. You have agency. There are some things that have more agency than you, others that have less. And that can be relative. I can kill a mosquito, or the mosquito can kill me. And one of the things I learned in exploring shamanism is one of the major tenets that I heard right away is everything is a relationship. It's not a one-way street. There's a reciprocal relationship between me and everything else, including whatever we want to call God. It's a give and take. It's okay with me that most of the power is someplace else, but there's a communication, which really leads to some interesting stuff about karma. I was hoping we could get back to that, Ben. And Joel and I can go around and around about this. So I've also been studying the mystic Paul Brunton. I don't know if any, and he's pretty eclectic. Probably one of his major influences was Ramana Maharshi, so the Hindu tradition, but he's pretty cool. So I think of it more this way, but it's in the Sufi tradition too. The universe has an intention. So Inayat Khan, the founder of the tradition I follow, he said something really provocative, still drives me crazy. He said, when you're a kid, you think God is on a cloud and has a beard and blah, blah, blah. Okay. But then you grow up and you realize, well, it's something else. And eventually you get to, I'm paraphrasing, he didn't say this, but it's like, well, then you study physics and you realize, well, God must be energy. And he says, yeah. And then he had this sentence he adds on to it. God is energy with a personality. What the hell do you do with that? And then he says, well, we all have personalities. So if we have personalities, where do you think that came from? Right? It's really interesting. Just that, and I take it metaphorically, but where it helped is that whatever the universe is, and if you want to call it God, okay. It has a direction. So the Sufis, the tradition I follow, would say that the direction is the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, whatever that means. Something we think of as good qualities, right? The form is not predetermined. The direction is something. The impulse, the karmic impulse, kind of, is towards some creation that will be loving, harmonious, and beautiful. What form that's going to take, that depends on the relationship between creation and the divine power. That's where our free will comes in. More provocatively, and this is where I was teasing Joel. I don't think Westerners can get karma, but I'm not an Easterner, so I don't know. And I was trying to look this up. I was hoping you know this, Richard, but I couldn't find it. I learned from Vellayan Inayat Khan, the son of Inayat Khan. He loved to say, the pull of the future is greater than the push of the past. And then I was just studying something for the class I'm going to give. And he took that from a polymath in, I think, the 13th century, and I can't find his name. I don't know if you know, it begins with an E, I think. But it didn't come from the Sufi. It came from from
From a Christian mystic of some sort?
no, it wasn't a man, it was a scientist. He was into everything, you know, one of those great
Interesting.
philosophers who was a mathematician and a philosopher and a whatever. So here's how I think of it. There's a direction, and the universe is like a tractor beam in Star Trek. We have free will, and we can resonate with the universe's direction, or we can go off half-cocked. But there's a relationship, right? And the universe can take anything we do and try to bring it back like a tractor beam to be back in resonance with the direction towards something that'll be loving, harmonious, and beautiful. Or you take Desjardins' Omega Point. There's something we're heading toward that is pulling us. That's different than karma from the past pushing us in a direction. So that philosopher or the Sufi saying, there's a pull of the future. So there, and what I loved about Vilayat, he was fond of saying, it's not either or, it's and. There's karma, there's natural consequences. You know, you reap what you sow. Yes. Also, there is just plain luck, happenstance. And there's a pull, there's a push, there's a pull, and there's just plain luck. And the trust that a lot of us talk about, especially the shamans, but we all say, or the idea, which I don't like the way it's phrased, you know, everything is perfect the way it should be. That phrase drives me nuts. The way I interpret it that makes me, my heart and mind feel a little bit better is the universe is powerful enough that it can take whatever something is and pull it back in resonance. It's that powerful. So, yeah, there are karmic influences. And there are times when the divine, through Christian grace, I don't know another word, you can use whatever word you want, that says, eh, right, I don't care. I'm pulling you. I always make fun of St. Paul. He was karmically influenced to do blah, blah, blah. And God said, I'm going to knock you off your horse. And all of a sudden, how'd that happen? You know, so you can have a circular argument and say, oh, that's karma, karma too, and all of that. I think it's just a fascinating dance. It's a little bit of this, a little bit of this, it's a little bit of this. And yeah, there's an interplay of sometimes this is more powerful, that's more powerful, and there's an ultimate power that I know is greater than anything else in creation that I know of, or can intuit. But we have agency. And the evolution is towards creation that has greater and greater agency that will help create a form that will embody the intention of the universe.
So, and I'd love to hear you and Joel argue. That would be really kind of cool. We're comments, but I'm just
You can run the next podcast and you can figure it out, sure.
so the situation is such that we are the universe. We are aspects of the universe. The universe though knows where it's going because it has a telos. It has a direction. But we also have free will, so it's partly discovering where it's going through our active choices in the present. So we're the universe helping to discover itself in each one of us individual. So that sounds a lot like what Joel would say. I want to hear Joel tell Henry why he's full of crap, and then you guys, one thing lead to another. No, I'm
Well,
just
I
curious.
think on that note, I think we're almost out of time. So,
Actually, Henry, we're just beginning. It's called part two.
So Henry was talking about how we'll never figure it out. And I mean, just take a look at physics now. We're making progress, and then all of a sudden the universe is accelerating and there's dark energy, there's dark matter. We do not know what it is. We can only infer that it exists. So that's going to be,
yeah.
So we'll be grappling with that for the next, 100 years, 1,000 years, who knows?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I was reminded of David Bohm, who everybody's probably familiar with. You guys, right? His notion of the implicate wholeness in his famous book, Wholeness in the Implicate Order, about he was as quantum physicists go, he was of the what they called hidden variable school, as opposed to say Bohr's Copenhagen interpretation, or like the many worlds interpretation, which is out there. I always liked David Bohm though, because he had this very Advaita Vedanta-esque conception of the physical universe, where you have what he called the explicate order of physical reality, which is what can tangibly be understood and grappled with by the physical sciences, and then what he called, and correct me if I'm not doing this justice, guys, and then what he called the implicate order, which the explicate order is enfolded in and comes from the implicate order, and that implicate order are the very fundamental deep levels, say, laws of physics and information, quantum information that the physical universe springs from. And then beneath that, there's what he called the super implicate order, which is, and he didn't talk much about that, right? He talked about the implicate and the explicate, but there is also this notion, and that's what really fascinates me, about the super implicate order, which kind of reminds me of call it what you will, Sufi God or Hindu Brahman, or the Tao, or of Taoism, that transcends yin and yang, but it can't be named. It's an order that transcends anything that we can start putting labels on, but it is the potentiality. Maybe you'd call it energy in physics, the potentiality from which what we see as physically possible emerges. But isn't that itself? So I don't know. I just reminded me.
That ties in, I believe, to the wave function. The wave function. There's all this potential.
Yes.
The electron can be anywhere in the universe, but then when you actually examine it, it materializes it in a specific time and location.
Excellent. Yeah, I'd say that's another great quantum physics parallel, isn't it? Yeah. I don't know. It just reminds, when you mention physics, I don't know. I'm more interested in hearing what Joel has to say about karma that disagrees with you.
Well, I mean, fundamentally, this is just, and I mean, all honor and respect to Henry, his teaching, what he offers. He's guided many great, great wisdom and understanding. The fundamental difference is that I feel that we are in an unseen field.
Hmm.
The unseen field is shunyata, is emptiness. So when we talk about a garden in the unseen field, the field is the garden and the garden is emptiness, but the garden manifests in form as the garden. And I, as a part, am both the totality of shunyata, of emptiness. There's nowhere that I exist in time and space, and yet I'm here in time and space. The totality of that is that my actions in time and space generate in the unseen realm karmas. My every action, thought, and speech, every intention that I have, the Zohar says this, Hinduism, Buddhism all say this, that even now as I generate loving kindness for all beings without thought and without want of reward, whether I do or do not think of reward or wanting, the exact measure returns to me like in kind at the right time, dictated by the universe. So if I think about loving kindness for all beings with a specific goal and outcome, that returns to me like in kind. The goal and the outcome translated back to me perfectly at a time in the future. It's a seed of karma. If I think of loving kindness for all beings with no goal, no thought, then that iteration, that specific iteration, returns to me like in kind in the future. Mm-hmm. The universe is the ascriber, the accountant. God is the great accountant. God, and it's not, there's no effort in it for God. God only utilizes it for highest good, that at the right time, the rudeness that I have expressed or the harm that I have expressed, God will utilize that constructively at the best time, as God knows. And so every moment we are generating karma, every moment we are generating the experiences of our future without even, I mean, this is the whole vital notion of Zazen or meditation, yoga, vital practices, to awaken to the reality that it's not just I'm being kind to you five or being rude to you five. I'm shaping my experience in future incarnations and maybe this incarnation. That is not knowable, whether it's this incarnation or future incarnations, but let me assure you that I'm shaping the quality of my life and lessons. I am calling forth my own lessons with the generative intention, thought, action, and speech that I issue each moment. So I'm the bridge I walk upon is the bridge I build. It cannot be another way. And this is the deepest mystical esoteric teachings of all traditions. If you get in the mystical traditions of Christianity, what is Jesus talking about? For what is as you sow, so shall you reap. As you sow your intention, thought, action, and speech, you will reap the exact intention, thought, action, speech. In Judaism, it's known as measure for measure. The Zohar says that everything we put out in the universe is reflected back to us exactly in the measure that we offer it. This is so vital to understand why loving kindness, why chesed, why kindness is highest wisdom, because this is what we will experience for ourselves. It's not just that we're benefiting our community through kindness, we're also shaping our own future. So someone who has a very strong generative force of loving kindness in previous incarnations and falls into a condition like I have of great suffering, I in part could intuitively attribute my health now, my ability to pull out of insanely traumatic experiences, great difficulty, the generative force of loving kindness in previous incarnations, my own heart has brought me to the fruition of health now, by God's attributing good conditions and good circumstances. Once I learned the lessons of the suffering, it's my own generative force of loving kindness for everything that has brought me to health. And so I don't say that because I should have accolades for loving kindness. By default, nobody should have accolades for loving kindness because it should be as ubiquitous as air and dirt and sky and water. We shouldn't even have to mention it. We should all just be kind because it's the only, ultimately, the only lasting thing here. If you look at creation itself, what is it? It is kindness. It is a gift. God has given us this experience. So when we want to mirror him, we're in his likeness and image. When we want to mirror God or be in his image, we are kind because God is kind. But I know Henry just has a different take on it. And I don't know that if Henry and I were to talk for a long time, we would probably resonate at very similar places with both seeing and knowing and understanding that the other is absolutely correct.
What you guys are saying both resonate with me harmoniously. I don't hear any point of disagreement there, but maybe.
Yeah, it has to come up the way we interpret reincarnation. But really? That's for another discussion.
Yeah.
There's a twist to that I find really helpful, but it's hard to.
Yeah,
we're going to have to wrap up pretty soon, right?
By wrap up, Henry means we just met the quarter mark of this podcast.
Yeah, all right.
And we should be done by 9 o'clock, Henry. Don't worry. I know you're not tired yet. So.
Before we started the recording, you had asked us, what do you want? Remember?
Yeah, I do.
And I had a flash. It isn't just the content. It's the process. What does spirituality in action mean to you? But it really made me think about what we're doing. A loosely knit group of people that don't really have a formal membership in something, but really get excited about what's meaningful and want to bring that in and support each other that way.
So I guess, yeah, and wrapping up, I'm just wondering, close out with you and then I'll close out, but you know, Rich or Andy or Ben, thoughts or reflections, the final things you'd like to share or say, ideas for the future, what arises for you, Rich? What arises for you?
I just, you know, what Henry said, you know, is absolutely true. A spiritual path for me has always been a very solitary exercise and kind of a lonely one at times. And the work, and I really mean, I can't stress enough that the work you guys do in general, with all the projects and initiatives you have is incredible. It's exactly what I think, you know, the spiritual landscape needs and the spiritual seekers need to find kindred souls. I know for me, it's so important. Every one of these is absolutely invaluable to me. As soon as you guys start talking, it generates so many questions that I just can't, you know, I only asked about, you know, 5% of what I wanted to. And meeting Annie and Ben, it was great meeting you guys. I mean, what you shared was fantastic. So thank you.
Yeah. And Rich, I just want to let you know, I can't speak for Ben and Andy because they're newer, but I know both Henry and I and you feel like we all talk too much. Like I feel like I have to tap out because I you know, I have to be cognizant that I have a tendency to.
Rich, your questions were great. They really moved us forward. Oh, I wouldn't feel bad at all. No, I think they're great.
Thank you.
Yeah, Ben, he does this every podcast. He orders people to elicit their highest wisdom. That is like, wow, that's amazing. But he's the facilitator for it, but he doesn't recognize it, you know?
That was great.
But Ben, go ahead.
I didn't get to speak much on karma, and I was really liking the reflection you both had a minute ago, but I was thinking, you're talking a lot about collective karma, which is something I haven't thought or learned much about, but I think of individual karma. And back to the I'm not worthy or the opposite of he who exalts himself will be humbled. I think having an identity, you know what I mean? Having a major sense of self that is separate from others, again, back to that. You know, we would say in math, 7 and -7 still have a value of 7. If you're truly humble, you're at an even point. And when you can get there, I think when you can realize that you're not separate and there is no major identity, you can be free of your karmic obstructions more. So, I mean, we've all got our habit patterns and everything, and you can be more in line with the universe's energy and the natural loving kindness and the natural gratitude when you can truly reach that real humility where you're no better or no worse. You can be free of your habit forces and be more spontaneous and more from the hara, more from the heart, and just resonate more with that natural love and kindness that is kind of the universe's will. That's my take on individual karma, but I think it gets into the collective karma, as you guys touched on wonderfully as well.
Beautiful. Andy?
Yeah, thanks, Ben. I learned a lot today, and I just wanted to say, I appreciate Ben just because of our similar, you know, our similar background. So, but I appreciate everyone that was here, and thanks for allowing me to be a part of it.
Of course, Andy, Ben, Rich, you know, just for a moment, could I just say, you know, Ben, Ben and Andy haven't been on these podcasts before, but Ben, we are longtime travelers on, I don't know what you'd call it, but just walking, I guess, walking through life. We've been fellow travelers. And Andy and I, also both located in Buffalo, really appreciate both your hearts, the genuine quality, the purity of your heart.
Thank you. That helps a lot. You know, I'm still trying to get balanced. And I love the comment about seven and negative seven, and someone else mentioned the balance. I'm working on it, and I'm early. I'm still early in my recovery.
Yeah. Well, I mean, regardless if you're early or late, Andy, these states of recovery or non-recovery, I mean, they're important for your health and quality of life, but deeper than the recovery or non-recovery is a quality of heart that always shines through. Henry, final thoughts, reflections?
No, I shared my thoughts about this being like a cafe that I really enjoy being part of. And one last thing, the Sufis say that the best interaction is done in the silence.
And so I just want to thank everyone, Rich and Andy, Ben and Henry. Again, this is a collaboration between Alchemical Dialogues podcast and Unraveling Religion podcast. Henry and I have been at this for a little while now. And, you know, it deepens as time goes. And I'm very grateful for this time and place. But I wanted to close out actually with a Zen koan. Poe asked, what is the overall meaning of the Buddhist teaching? The master said, don't commit any evils, practice the many virtues. Po said, even a three-year-old child could say this. The master said, though a three-year-old child can say it, an 80-year-old man cannot put it into practice. Po then bowed and departed. So wherever that leaves you, in whatever ways that you can cultivate your own deepest nurturance of self, may be found for each of us.